Blog Talk Radio. Hello, and welcome to Nice Girls Reading Naughty Books. I'm your host, Bernadette Walsh. And I'm so pleased to introduce my guest this evening, Laquette. Laquette is a romance author of bold, provocative love stories featuring multicultural characters. She often crafts emotionally epic, fantastical tales that are deeply pigmented by reality's paintbrush. A Brooklyn, New York native, Laquette is a best-selling romance author, and her awards include the 2016 Author of the Year Golden Apple Award. Her titles include Under His Protection and The Queens of Kings. So welcome, Laquette, to Nice Girls Reading Naughty Books. How are you?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm well. All things considered, what's going on in the world, I have no complaints.
I know. It's been, we were talking about it before we joined. It's, you know, my heart goes out to everyone who's impacted, obviously, by the coronavirus. But even for those of us who are not directly impacted in the sense that we're still healthy, it's just such a stressful time. You know, we're both New Yorkers, so we are, you know, trapped in our houses, and it's, you know, and with families and everything else, it really is a difficult time. So I appreciate you, joining me. And so for a half hour, we can forget, you know, that we're trapped in our houses and maybe focus on what we love, which is, you know, romance.
Absolutely.
And actually, Laquette,
I'm all for that.
Yes, absolutely. So, Laquette, I think we have two things in common that you may not be aware of. One, we are both originally Brooklyn girls. I was Brooklyn born as well. Yeah. And my dad was in Brooklyn. I lived in Brooklyn until I was around 10. And then when I was an adult, my husband and I found him in Brooklyn. He was a Bay Ridge boy. And we lived there for a while. Then we moved out to Long Island, so which is kind of like Brooklyn anyway. But we're both Brooklyn girls. And the other thing we have in common, I was looking at some of your covers, and I saw a couple of them had redhead boys. So the ginger boys don't often get a lot of love.
Well, I can't even say that it was really that he was a ginger boy. You're talking about His True Strength, which is the last book in the Queens of Kings series. That character came out of my head, genuinely speaking, because I had to make a phone call to PayPal because there was some sort of issue going on with my account at the time, and to rectify it, I had to call them. And the representative had the loveliest accent that I'd ever heard a man speak with. And I was so entranced by his voice and his speech that I could hardly stay focused on the business matter that I was calling him about. And at the end of the transaction, he was like, "Do you have any more questions?" And I said, "Yes. I know this is going to sound really weird, but your accent is lovely, and I really just would like to know where you hail from or where in the world you are right now, because it's not one that I readily recognize." Because, you know, from New York, everyone from everywhere in the world is in New York. So you get a feel of the different dialects and things of that nature. But I had not actually heard his, and he was from Ireland. He said to me, "I am from the People's Republic of Ireland." And I was like, "I need to write an Irish character." Like, I just need to, after listening to this man's dreamy voice for, you know, all of 5 minutes on the phone. So that's where Teague came from, my fantasizing about the nice person that helped me with my PayPal issue.
Oh, wow. Well, isn't it amazing what inspires you? You know, the PayPal inspired you. I actually my husband actually is from Dublin. So I get to hear that accent all the time.
Oh, you're so fortunate. It was so dreamy. It really was. I was mesmerized by it. I really was.
Oh, that's so cool. That's so cool. So listen, why don't we talk about, how long you've been writing and what got you interested in romance?
Well, I'm an academic. I've spent a good amount of years teaching English lit and comp and research writing. So there's all, you know, writing is always associated with the teaching. But I started writing romances probably like literally 20 years before I actually started publishing them. I just knew that I was reading, like my first romance novel was The Devil's Price by Carol Mortimer. And it completely, like, I was completely entrenched in it. I mean, I really could not put it down. I read it in one sitting. And I knew then that I wanted to do something like that. But I couldn't find books that really featured women of color and didn't really feature a lot of Brooklynites. So I started kind of creating my own stories probably when I was about 18, 19. And that kind of led me in the direction of studying literature and writing for many years after that. But I started publishing probably about 6 or 7 years ago.
And so what made you decide to, how did you get the courage to say, well, I can start telling my own stories?
I had just finished my master's degree, my thesis and my defense of my thesis. I was tired of writing stories, or rather writing for a specific reason, like in academia in terms of defending whatever it was I was arguing at that point. I didn't want to write what other people were telling me to write, which is what you do as a student, a graduate student. And I wanted to just write something that was all about my id, that was all about consumption and just enjoyment. And so I just sat down and I started writing this story that just kind of came out of nowhere. And my husband read the first half of it. And I think I didn't finish the second half because we got pregnant with our first son shortly thereafter. And so it kind of fell by the wayside. And he kept saying to me, you know, I really think you should do something with this. It was really good. And I'm still, you know, I'm waiting on the second half of it to figure out what happens. And my husband is not by any stretch of the imagination a person that reads romance, but he was really into the book, what I've written thus far. And so I thought, well, if he, you know, being a computer tech guy who could care less about, you know, romance, if he's that intrigued by it, then maybe people who actually like romance would find this interesting. And so I started, I made the decision to kind of to self-publish at that time. And I didn't have a lot of knowledge about self-publishing, but putting that book out put me on the radar of a small press called Hot Ink Press. And I wrote for them for a couple of years. The first four books of the Queens of Kings series were published through them. And from that, that led me to my journey to RWA and traditional publishing.
And so how many books have you published at this point?
I've published 11 total. And I am currently working on three series for three separate publishers. I don't know what I was thinking at the same time. So I'll be writing for the next 2 years. It's a good problem to have, but, you know, it can be a little overwhelming when you think about it.
That's amazing. That is amazing. And so it's, yeah, quite a journey. You know, now is writing something that you do full time at this point?
Yes,
or do you
I am
have a day job?
I'm a full-time writer. No, wow. Writing is my day job. This is what I do. It's what I have seriously invested in. And it's why I take it so seriously, because it is my profession. It is my job.
Well, that's great. I mean, you are now living my fantasy life because unfortunately I still have my day job. So writing is something that I kind of fit in, but it's amazing that you made it your full-time thing. And it sounds like you're having enormous success with it. Now, maybe you can talk about how, was it hard for you to transition from writing about, you know, academic writing and then moving that into fiction writing? What were some of the hurdles you may have experienced?
I think I was always a fiction writer. I just didn't really know much about format and formula and how stories, like the format of stories and what they should look like in the printed word, in the printed form. I knew I was a storyteller. I knew how to tell a story, but I didn't necessarily know how to use the skills that we use as writers to keep your audience actively engaged in the text. And so I started reading these books, and I love them, but I kind of thought, well, I really need to know how to write, you know, professionally. And so I decided to take up writing in college. So I had already been to school, and I had an associate's at that point in respiratory therapy, and I was practicing as a respiratory therapist. There was something so very serious about the yearning to write that I went back to school and got a bachelor's degree in creative writing because I really wanted to understand how writing worked and, you know, what my job would really entail as a writer. And I was fortunate because in that, I think I learned a special appreciation for all forms of writing that I don't think I would necessarily have if I had come to writing just because I loved reading. It taught me why I loved reading things and, again, how to make my readers love reading my books. And so for me, and that's not the path that everyone needs to take. I don't think anyone needs that. I'm just saying I'm hard-headed, and for me, for it to penetrate into my head, that's what I needed. And so doing that and putting that kind of energy, because I'm that person, like if I really like something, I go all at it. I put 100% into it because I really want to know the ins and outs of how something works in order for me to get a handle on it. So after studying literature for a while, I decided it was time to actually put all of the things that I had learned between my bachelor's and my master's degree and those two programs and put it into actual practice and put it out into the world. And I think that people, they dismiss romance as literature, but for me, I always saw romance as literature. So there was never any sort of divide for me in, oh, you're studying literature, but you want to write romance. To me, it's all the same. I mean, it's different genres, of course, but good writing is good writing, and it doesn't really matter what genre you choose to write in.
Well, I think that is a hurdle that a lot of romance writers have to overcome, right? Because the prejudice, in a sense, against romance writing. But on some level, you're right. Good writing is good writing, and if you don't have the good writing, you won't rise to the top. So I think, you know, I dip in and out of romance. I think I started with romance because, you know, I always talked about writing. And, you know, I was just, it was a fantasy almost for me. And I said, well, maybe someday when I retire, you know, I'll be able to sit on the beach and, I don't know, write a romance novel. And when I was 40, I hit 40, I was like, I ticked all the other boxes in my life, right? I got married, had a baby, finally. And I had my career, which I'm a lawyer. And that was a big focus for me for a long time. But I turned 40 and I was like, there's something missing. That whole year, I was like, what is missing? And it was the creative side that I never allowed myself the room to explore. And so what I did was, obviously, I'd already kind of started down a road with a career. And so I just took little steps. You know, I started, I bought myself my husband actually bought me a computer. And I joined a local writing group. And I tried to teach myself in a lot of ways, because although I had, you know, I did a lot of writing in my professional life as a lawyer, that's what you do is a lot of writing. It's very, very different. That kind of legal writing is very, very different from putting it into fiction. And as you said before, you know, just being a reader, I think that, you know, look, I think you have to be a reader in order to be a writer, but that doesn't go all the way. It doesn't help you structure and all the things that as a reader, you almost don't notice because you're caught up in the story. You don't see, you know, all the, the underpinnings of the story. And so that's what I had to kind of learn. And so that's why, you know, Romance Writers of America, you know, look, it's a flawed institution in a lot of ways, but it has a, it was my entree into writing, because I couldn't take the time, although I would love to, right? I'd love to go back to school and study like you did, because that's, you know, I think that's a lot of people's ideal, but that just wasn't practical for me. So I had to do it, you know, a little bit at a time. And that's, that is, you know, my local writing group, they taught me, you know, in a very loving way.
Yeah.
You know, my first draft of my first book was horrendous. and they taught me why it was horrendous. And they helped me, you know, get from point A to point B. So, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was about to say, you know, you have this academic background and you have actually contributed so much to other writers. You know, maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the sessions that you run and some of the training and some of the themes you explore in that training.
Well, right now I'm teaching a lot of RWA chapters what I've called my critical lens class. And it is really a course that really focuses on learning how to identify problematic content, problematic and harmful content in your work. And what I mean by that is basically writing things that are offensive to marginalized groups and communities. And especially when you are not from one of those communities, it can be really easy, even without the intention, right? Even if your intent is to do something really good and to make your work inclusive, if you don't understand people's perspectives and why they have those perspectives and how your perspective may differ from theirs and why, if you don't understand that, then you can find yourself inadvertently doing more harm than good. And so my course focuses on using literary criticism, which is basically identifying different schools of literary thought and applying them to work and to literature, and using that to analyze not just what the text is on its face, but the things that we don't see that goes into a text, things like the author voice, things like what influences the author had or what was going on in that person's life culturally, what was going on in their environment, whether or time period. You know, there are lots of things that happen historically that have a major impact on people individually. And, you know, if you don't recognize those things, you might not understand the depth of which this author is trying to bring those ideas and those experiences into their writing. And for you, it may just be something that you feel it can be glossed over, but without understanding a perspective, you won't get the real value of the work. And so what I basically do is teach people through literary criticism to learn to value the perspective and the experience of marginalized communities and groups.
And do you see, at least in the groups that you've been working with, that more people are trying to write from other perspectives and include more more of a multicultural, you know, cast of characters in their books?
I think that is definitely so. But it's not just multiculturalism. It's also identity. It's, you know, LGBTQ plus people. Mm-hmm. It's disabled people. It's all of these marginalized groups that people are aware of and understand that have, you know, basic understanding that they should be putting them in their books, because we exist in real life. And if you're going to write what we call realistic fiction, you should have, you know, elements of realism into your fiction. And when you don't put those sorts of communities in your book, when your book is extremely homogenous, you are making a statement. You are making a choice, because most of the world is not homogenous. Most of us live in a place, or most of us, if we're not having direct contact with people from marginalized communities, we do know they exist, though. And so to write a story that's, you know, placed in, set in New York, but you have no people of color or no LGBTQ plus people or no disabled people, like, New York has accessibility, like, built into a lot of its infrastructure. So even to get on the subway, there are certain stops, not all of them, but the, many of the major stops have elevators for people who can't, you know, get up and down stairs that will take you from the street level to the subway platform. So when you write a story about New York and you're writing it and you're not placing these people from these groups and these communities into your story, even in a secondary or tertiary fashion, you are making a deliberate choice, which is either because you have no interest in painting your picture that way, or it's because you are afraid to do it because you're afraid you're going to do something wrong. And so that's where my class sort of comes in. I don't teach people, you know, things like skin color and hair texture, because that's really irrelevant and really has nothing to do with what makes a person who they are and what their identity, what the perspective of their identity is. And also it doesn't really do anything because people of color have all sorts of textures and hair textures and skin colors. So me trying to teach you that would be, you know, it wouldn't serve you at all. We're not a monolith. We're not all the same. And so you can't write us all the same. But if you understand why, how inflicting your view on my life and my experience minimizes and diminishes my experience and my value and my contribution to the overall society and the overall genre, then once you understand that, then you'll start to kind of think, well, wow, like, I didn't understand before why this was a problem, but now that I've kind of understood, you know, we discuss things like double consciousness, we discuss all sorts of other theories that come into play when we're talking about literary criticism. And those things, really, the reason they're called schools of thought is because it is a collective of experiences, you know, that have been sort of analyzed coming from different groups of people. And it helps people who are not part of that group really to understand, or objectively, because you can't really subjectively understand what it is to be marginalized if you're not from a marginalized group yourself. But it can sort of help you understand objectively why people might feel a certain way about a certain thing, right? Like, if you've never lost your parents, so to speak, right? But a friend loses their parent, even though you don't really subjectively understand what it is to have lost your parent, you have empathy. You understand that this is a really bad thing for this person in most cases, and I understand why they are hurt and upset, and why, you know, why they feel the way they feel about this person's loss. But for some reason, people aren't able to turn that empathy on when it comes to marginalized perspectives, not so readily. But if you think of it that way, it's really just about understanding empathy.
That's a great example. That really is a great example. And you don't see what you don't, you know, see, right? It sounds like maybe sometimes people are blinded. And I think the other point you bring out is, which is that people are maybe afraid. They're afraid to mm-hmm. step wrong and to do it wrong. So they're like, yes, I just won't do it at all. But you're right. It kind of, and I'm guilty of it in my own writing. I kind of write from my own mm-hmm. perspective. A lot of my stories are, you know, about Irish America or people in Ireland, because that's what's most accessible to me. But it is something mm-hmm. I have thought about as well in terms of my next book. How do I expand that? Because it's, first of all, it makes for a richer reading experience for your readers.
Yes.
And it also expands mm-hmm. the universe of people who want to read your book. You
yes.
know what I mean? If there's more that they can connect with. So so I think it's, you're doing a great service.
It also normalizes the appearance of marginalized groups in books without without spotlighting them in a negative way, meaning we're not making their marginalization the focus, or we shouldn't be making their marginalization the focus of their identity in the book. It should be that they are there, that mm-hmm. they should be there, and it should be normal that they're there. Because if you, as a white author, write that sort of scenario, it doesn't seem so strange when I do it, when I write that character, when I write books featuring people of color, because readers have already seen it in mainstream. But if me not being part of the mainstream, if I am attempting to write this and mainstream is not at all including it into their work, then it looks like something different. It looks like something other. It looks like something that is not a part of the norm that the standard that we are used to having. So by having by creating diverse casts, you are normalizing the existence of these people, of these groups inside of the romance world, and then romance readers will get used to seeing them and won't think that they're so strange when people from those communities actually write books about their own love stories.
That's a great point. That's a great point. And in the same way, so when you include multicultural characters in your own books, like the Irish boy who inspired you from PayPal, that, again, if people have seen that in other stories, that you're right, it becomes more normalized. That's a great point. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think you're doing a great service for other writers to mm-hmm. opening up their lens. Because, look, the writing process, the story comes to you as it comes to you, right? And it's only mm-hmm. when... You know, I think constant learning and constant exposure that you think, okay, I'm starting a new story. You know, where can I maybe I would normally have my character look like X or be an X type of character. And then I could consider them a Y character. You know what I mean? Like, so it's opening up mm-hmm. your lens. I guess one question I would ask you, and I'm the reason why I'm asking is because I just finished a book by a fairly well-known romance writer, women's fiction writer. And, only because I'm kind of in the romance, the RWA community, you could see what this concept of multicultural characters has been talked about. And I could see that this writer was trying to expand her normal universe. But I felt the way that she did it was a little jarring because she had a lot of her main character, and I'm not going to identify her because, like, first of all, I'm a mm-hmm. big fangirl and I think she was trying to do some good things, but I think maybe she could have done it in a different way. And I just wanted your thoughts. You know, her main characters were still, you know, white people, right? All the main characters, mm-hmm. love interests, the family, you know, they were all white characters. But she had a lot of multicultural, characters that were tertiary characters. Mm-hmm. But I felt like she didn't do a great job of, they were just kind of there. And like, you know, one of them was a neighbor who was, you know, Latin and was singing, you know, in the backyard or something. And mm-hmm. I felt like it was jarring because she didn't interact with this neighbor. He could have been cut completely out of the character. And I was like, well, what are you trying to show? Like that your neighbor is Latin? Like, is that what you're trying to show? And I mean, okay, but you didn't interact with him. You know what I mean? And then I just felt like the character, like a lot, and then she was at a party. And so there was, you know, an Indian family is a party. And then, you know, like, it was kind of a lot, but I felt like, I was like, if you're going to have these characters, they should be
they
in
should
the
have
story.
Substance. Yeah. See, the problem with that is that you're basically making cardboard cutouts of diverse people, putting them in your book, and expecting that to be enough, but no, it's not. So I always use this analogy to help people understand how to really create a marginalized character and insert them into your story, even when they're not the main character, right? So we get caught up in our main character, and the whole book has to be about those two characters. Yes, we know that, right? But we also, you know, we all, for our main characters, we always have goal, motivation, and conflict. We always have a full arc, that emotional arc that this person has to, you know, these people have to go through. But they don't oftentimes, especially when it comes to writing outside of their own experience, when they put these marginalized people in these stories, they're not giving them a full arc. So they come off very shallow, very superficial. A great way to think about how to do this is to watch Marvel's Captain America Civil War. And you're going to think it's strange, but I promise you it makes sense. The protagonists in the story are Captain America and Iron Man, and they're having a clash, a difference of opinion that leads to the Avengers splitting up into two factions, two teams. In all of that going on, we meet T'Challa, who at the time when we first meet him is the prince of Wakanda, and he is being doted on by his father, King T'Chaka. We meet him as a loving son who adores his father and who is also adored by his father. He is the jewel of his father's eye, and it's just a really sweet, tender moment. We get to see him exchange with his father when we first meet him. Very shortly after we meet him, his father is killed, and he is moved from being the adoring prince to he has to become king and is Black Panther, which is the protector of his country. And as the protector of his country, it now becomes his responsibility to get justice for their slain king. So we've moved him from this really, really, you know, this early meet cute sort of situation to giving him a start to the hero's journey. And mind you, he's not the hero. He's not the hero of the story, because that's for Iron Man and Captain America. He's really a secondary character. He doesn't really have a whole lot of time on screen. But in the few scenes that he does have on screen, you get to see him moving to the completion of this arc. And by the end of the story, he's actually understood that, one, he was chasing the wrong villain, and that, two, what he thought he was seeking was justice, but it was, in fact, vengeance. And that he can't allow vengeance to consume him, because that is not the man that his father raised him to be. And that is not the king, the type of king his people need. It sounds like so much, but it happens very quickly. And again, with very few scenes where he is the focus, all the while all of this other stuff is going on with Captain America and Iron Man. And he's such a full character that by the time he gets his own movie in Black Panther, we feel like we know him already. We've seen where his beginning comes from and what his goal and his motivation has been, and we're ready to see what this new journey is that he's going to partake on. So when you are writing a character that is out of your experience, it's not enough just to put them in the story. You've got to give them an emotional arc. It doesn't have to be huge. It doesn't have to spotlight them. But your reader should be able to see emotionally what has changed about this character from when they first came onto the scene to when they're, you know, the end of the book.
And I think part of that as the writer's responsibility is to be get to before you publish a book with characters that maybe you're not necessarily as comfortable writing, you have to get to the comfort level and so that you're willing to put in the work to make them real characters. And I think a lot of that, and again, I'm going back to this book that I just read, was you can't make them all perfect either, right? Because then they're not a fully fleshed out character. So because you're afraid
you can't make them.
Yeah,
you can't make them all perfect, but they can't be perfect people. But also the problem is I find that a lot of people are stalled or they're stuck because they have this idea in their heads of what marginalization is. So they want to write a Black character. They have this idea in their heads of what Blackness actually is and what Black people are. And the truth of the matter is, what makes you think you really can identify that, especially if you're not Black yourself? How can you really say what it is to be a Black person or an LGBTQ plus person or disabled person if you're not experiencing that? So what I tell people is stop trying to write a Black character. Write a character who happens to be Black. write a fully fleshed out character and present them as whatever that marginalization is. If you write a fully fleshed out character, you know, people are not looking for the things that you are signaling for blackness, so to speak. So when, and that's the problem, is a lot of people, what they assign to race or attributes they assign to any culture or community, they assign that because this is what the media, what the entertainment industry, what they've read, what they've heard, what they've seen on TV, this is what they know of a community. And so they repeat these same stereotypes in a book and think, but that's what I see on TV. That's what this is, right? This is the culture. And it's like, no, you saw a very curated, oftentimes, view of what that community's experiences are. So I think we need to, especially authors who are not part of a community, you need to stop coming up with your own ideas about what that community is. That community gets to define themselves. You can't define them. And if you can't define them, then you can't really write what I call the struggle story, which is stories that are based and steeped only in that person's struggle, meaning the conflict is their identity. They are conflicted because of their identity. So if they are black, all of the bad things in their world are happening to them in the story because they are black. If they are gay, all the bad things that are happening to them because they are gay. If they are disabled, all of the bad things that happen to them in the story are happening because of their disability. Conflict does not equal identity. And I think that becomes sort of an easy target for non-marginalized authors to reach for when they want to tell a story featuring marginalized people. But you don't have to do that. Like, there are other compelling stories other than the struggle of a community. Focus on the humanity of the community, not the struggle. The struggle is part of their humanity, is not the sum total of it. And I think if we get to that part where we're realizing that people are not their conflicts, you know, that identity is not something we should have to be conflicted about, we will move away from this ideology that the only compelling story featuring marginalized people is about their struggle.
Right. So I think I think it's all about, from the writer's perspective, educating yourself and you know, again, I think moving out of your comfort zone and doing it in the best way you possibly can. And I think that is really, trying to, think about and be very thoughtful about when you're adding those characters. And like you said,
absolutely,
try not to be, stereotype. I mean, and I even see it like, I'm from an Irish family. I'm married to an Irish man. And a lot of times, there's also stereotypes about Irish people in the community, from the media that we're all, obviously Patrick's Day, stuff, and we're all a bunch of alcoholics. And so, and so I sometimes react the same way when I read a book and there's an Irish character and I'm like, it's so, like, for me, it just feels so false, right? It's hitting the wrong lines because somebody just took the very surface really knowing. If you have an Irish character, like, especially like an Irish born character, it's very hard for an American, I think, to write an Irish born character in a very authentic way without doing some research,
Just so you know, Teague is not Irish born.
I wasn't picking on your character, but I'm just saying this is an example, like, to kind of, So, well, maybe we can turn a little bit more towards the specifics of your writing. So in terms of the heat level of your books, are they hot? Where are they on the heat level?
My books are scorching. So if you are not, if you don't want to see sex on the page, don't pick up my books. They are filthy. They are. Every time I say that, I have a book called Bedding the Enemy, and the book actually starts with the sex scene. And every time I say how filthy the book is, Joanna Shoup, who she says to me, I love that book. I so love that book. I know. We all love it, but it's filthy. It really is. So not everyone really wants to read, explicit sex on the page. And I'm okay with that, right? I don't always read stories that only have explicit sex in them. But I'm just letting people know that if you're looking for heat, that's kind of one of the things that I do kind of well.
And you were able to do that right out of the gate. That was your first book, you were able to do that?
Because I think I write sex from the perspective that it is natural and that there's no reason to be ashamed of it. So, and I also write from the perspective that my characters have healthy sexual appetites as well as have no shame in their sexuality. So when they are engaged in physical intimacy with their partners, there's nothing to shy away from because this is something they both want. This is something that they're both willing to give their all for, and they're both very invested in pleasuring each other. So it really becomes an and sex also in my books is also a physical representation of the intensity of the emotion shared between the characters. So the sex you see them having, maybe in the earlier parts of the book is going to be different from sex that they're having toward the end of the book because the relationship is evolved and hopefully deepened. And so it's going to be much less about the physical experience than it is the emotional exchange.
And so that intensity, does that also loop in with the fact that I think you incorporate romantic suspense? Are a lot of your books romantic suspense or just some of your titles?
Well, the Queens of King series is a romantic suspense series. Betting the Enemy also has a bit of suspense attached to it. I don't really write true romantic suspense, so, if people are really, looking for heavy mysteries, you're not going to find that in my books. But they're generally contemporaries, high-heat contemporaries with, some suspense elements to them. I'm contracted to write a rom-com series for St. Martin's Press based on over 40-year-old women who are divorced and finding love for the second time in their lives. And those books, the heat will be hot as well. So it's not necessarily because of the suspense element. It's more how I feel my characters have to interact and express themselves. Because I believe wholeheartedly that sex is it's a natural part of expression for those of us who wish to express ourselves like that. And if that is the case, then we can't write sex as if it's something dirty. And when I say, I call it filthy, but I mean it in the best of ways. And I say it with the biggest smile on my face, if you could see me right now. But we can't, a lot of the reason I feel romance has this really bad rap in terms of, the sex that's depicted in our books is because the outside world really has this, I don't want to say puritanical, but really has this very conservative, narrow view of what sex and intimacy are and the impact of it on certain people's lives. So, if you're a person that's ace and physical sexual intimacy is not how you express your intimacy, then that doesn't apply to you. But for people who are, then why should we be afraid to show that? And I think that's the problem with romance in and of itself in terms of how people view us from the outside, because they're viewing it with this very conservative idea of sex being a bad thing and we need to hide it from the rest of the world. And I don't think that that's the case. I don't think of sex as a bad thing. I think if sex is something you are interested in and something you are consenting to have and something you want to do, then you should be allowed to do it as much as you want, as long as whomever you're having sex with equally wants this, consents to it, and is game for whatever it is you two have been talking about, thinking about doing.
Right. And there's a place for people who want to read about that. You know, not
mm-hmm.
everyone wants to, as you said, it's not everyone's jam, right? But if you want to, there should be good quality love stories that have the higher heat level. And what's wrong with that? You know, if you're an adult, you should be able to read it. So
you should be able to read those. If you're a responsible adult, you should be able to read those.
Right. Well, I'm impressed that you were able to go out of the gate. And the reason why I'm impressed is because that is an area from my writing that I've struggled with so much. My first book was a contemporary romance. It was called Gold Coast Wives. It was like really a chick litty kind of book. And my editor mm-hmm. at the time, I was with Lyrical Press, she said, look, this is a really great, and I see the story, I see the love story. She goes, but they've got to touch. This is a romance. They can't just like, you know, talk on the phone. There has to be some contact. And I finally, after, you know, being the uptight Irish Catholic girl that I am, I really struggled with it and was eventually able to kind of get there. But I've actually only been able to write hotter stories in my paranormal romance. And I think part of it is because my characters are so unlike me that a lot of my own inhibition
mm-hmm.
I can put to the side. So, you know, but I enjoy,
I can understand that. I mean, I don't necessarily think that all books need sex or all romances need sex. I think that you can tell a really compelling story without sex in a book. But it is my preference when I am writing to express emotional intensity through the act of sex. That is not something that needs to happen in every book. That is not something every author needs to do. That is not something that every book needs to have. And I've read romances that are sweet that have no sex in them. And they're beautiful stories. But I think the issue is that we get kind of wrapped up in this idea of what is the, because storytelling can be sort of formulaic. And so we have these expectations of what ingredients make a story. But I don't think that everyone needs to tell a story the exact same way. And I don't think every author needs to include sex in their books. I don't think every character needs to be all about the sex. I don't think every coupling or every pairing needs to be all about the sex. You can have an exchange of intimacy without physicality. That is very true. But the books that I tend to write, the way that my characters tend to express their emotions or their emotional connection is generally through sex in the book. And I for me, it works. I don't need everybody else to do it, and I'm not telling everybody else they have to do it, but for me,
No. And that's what makes it interesting. Like I said, you're right. There's especially in romance, there's so many different genres, and you can find something you like. And sometimes you're in the mood for a sweet romance, and sometimes you want something a little hotter. So you're fitting the bill with that. So I think that's great. And like I said, I was able to eventually get over it. I actually have written some hotter books, but that first one was a real struggle. So anyway, I wanted to tell you,
go ahead.
No. I also wanted to tell you that I absolutely love the name, The Queens of Kings. I thought that was like a really clever name. So I can't wait to check that out as well. I didn't interrupt you before.
People who are not from Brooklyn, if you're from Brooklyn, you kind of get it. but Brooklyn, Brooklyn is the county of Kings. It's called Kings County. Mm-hmm. And so when I say the Queens of Kings, I'm meaning women who are at the top of their field. You know, they are literally dominating their professions, and they're from Brooklyn. And so that is why that series was named The Queens of Kings, because it's about three women in particular who, as I said, are professionally dominant, and they're from Brooklyn. And through all of although their professional lives are very much set, their romantic lives are not lacking, but uncertain at that time because of the people that they're involved with.
Well, it sounds great. I wish I could talk for like another hour with you, Laquette, but we're actually running a little bit out of time. So maybe you could tell people where they could find you online and also what some of your upcoming or more recent releases are.
You can find me on Twitter at Laquette Writes. You can find me on Facebook at Laquette the Author. You can find me on Instagram at @la_Quet. I am writing a lot right now. So my latest release would probably be Under His Protection, which has the rights have since been reverted to me. So that will be re-released very soon. And then before that, probably Betting the Enemy. And I think that that's, that's a very unique entryway into my work. So if you're looking for the spicy stuff, if you really like a hot book, a hot little read, Betting the Enemy is definitely the way to go.
Well, and it sounds like there's a lot more great titles to come because it sounds like you've been very busy. And I would hope that you would let us know. Yeah, it sounds like you've been very busy. And so being under quarantine is probably not the best time. But I wish you good luck with that.
Got to get the work done.
Yep. I don't know if you've seen those like little memes on Facebook where, you know, the mom is at the computer and the children are like tied up. That's I can very much relate to that.
Yeah, if only it were legal, right? If only it were legal.
We just have to get through it. And that's what I tell my husband.
Yeah.
I was like, we just have to get through the next week. We just have to get through. I can't think that this is going to go on for multiple weeks, although I fear, of course, that it will. But, you know, we have to.
One day
at a time
is all you can do. Yeah,
that's right. That's
absolutely.
Right. And we have to. Keep writing. Well, anyway, thank you so much, Laquette. And if you can please let me know about your next upcoming releases, because I like to let people know on the Nice Girls Reading Naughty Books Facebook fan page what our prior guests are up to.
Oh, I certainly will. Of course.
Yeah. And
thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, I've enjoyed it as well. I've been following you on Twitter, secretly stalking you, and I've really enjoyed your tweets. And I also, you know, I saw your speech last year at the RWA conference. I didn't go, but I saw it online. So I was really, really thrilled that you agreed to this interview. So I really do appreciate
you
joining me. And I hope we can chat again sometime. So really best of luck. And
Absolutely. Please
keep in touch. And so just wanted to let everyone know, because I am on quarantine, I've set up some really great interviews for the next few weeks. So hopefully keep people entertained with podcasts as they're kept inside. Also wanted to let you know about some of my books. Cold Spring is free, and I'm going to keep that free for a while just as a little gift to people who are stuck inside. Also, my first book in my paranormal romance series, The Reluctant Witch, See Me, is available, and it's only 99 cents. So I'd appreciate if people would check that out. And covers and all buy links for all of my books are on my website, BernadetteWalsh.com. So thanks again for joining me. This is Bernadette Walsh of Nice Girls Reading Naughty Books, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.